Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. My name is Kevin Fukunaga, and you've joined the Scripts and Scribes Social. Many of us are socially distancing ourselves, so this is our opportunity to hear from other writers who are going through the same experience. Today, we're joined by a Sydney-based writer-director whose debut feature film, Outback, is being released on June 9th by Lionsgate on DVD, digital, and on demand. His shorts have screened around the world, including festivals in Melbourne, Seoul, and Berlin, and he's also been a judge at Scriptapalooza for over 7 years. He is Mike Green. Thanks for coming on today and chatting with us, Mike.
Hey, Kevin. Really happy to be here. A long-time listener and a big fan, so thanks for having me on.
Well, I appreciate it. No, I mean, I think you have an amazing story, and it's something that I think a lot of our listeners, especially listeners who aren't in the U.S., who aren't in Los Angeles, would find incredibly helpful, your experience, your insights, because you shot a feature film in Australia sort of on your own and independent way, and we're able to get distribution. So I want to get into all of that because it sounds amazing. I haven't seen it yet, but it sounds amazing. Comes out June 9th, again from Lionsgate. So we'll talk about that. But I also sort of wanted to take a step back and find out from you exactly how you got your start, how you got your start in the industry, how you became interested in, and how, what was your inspiration for wanting to become a filmmaker, a screenwriter and director?
Yeah, look, lots to unpack there.
Yeah.
The last question, like where I wanted to become a filmmaker, I'm in Australia. Half my family's in Los Angeles, so we've been going there as kids from a young age. And I remember going to Universal Studios and as a six-year-old and going on the Jaws ride and the Police Academy car kind of stunt event that they put on, and it was just so memorable. And I don't know if that's the seed of kind of, you know, my filmmaking germ that took off, but that's what I think I draw it back to. And then growing up on Spielberg films and being influenced by that, you know, it's kind of cliche to say, but that was what we were eating, digesting back then. And it was, yeah, inspirational.
And then where did you study, or where did you learn filmmaking? Was it a Tarantino school of hard knocks, watching films and just shooting your own stuff on the side? Or did you go to film school? How did you learn to make movies?
Yeah, look, a little bit. Like, maybe I'll, because I know that, like you said, there's a lot of listeners that are looking to make things or trying to, and they may not necessarily be in the States. So I'm 40-odd years old now. I've got a couple of young kids and a partner. So, you know, pretty stable life at the moment. I grew up and kind of out of school got into hospitality, and I used to open up and own restaurants and like hospitality venues. So they started off small and humble, but I always had the plan that I wanted to produce film in the long term. And I thought opening up these little venues and, you know, essentially having an audience come in, your clientele, and designing the restaurant or the cafe as a kind of themed concept. And I thought that was producery, because you're working to a budget and, you know, not entertaining people, but kind of giving them something to consume, whether that's something to watch or something to eat and drink. So I did that for a while, thinking that was good practice. Then I started, when I was maybe 30, making a few short films, tried to get into a couple of film schools. That didn't happen. And all the while, still making short films, but probably spending a little bit too much money on the short films too, looking back. You know, that'd probably be one bit of advice. Try not to spend much money at all on the content you're creating early on. So made a few short films. They started to do well, playing around the world and whatnot, not high level kind of Cannes or Sundance type shorts, really entry level kind of, you know, popular shorts, shall I call them. From my 30s, I said, you know, I need to get out of the hospitality industry and kind of give this filmmaking caper a real go. So I kind of down tools in the hospitality industry and essentially moved up to Sydney. I'm originally from Adelaide, which is a small town in Australia. Moved up to Sydney, Australia, and then started from the ground up working as a runner, making coffees for people, as a PA in the film, TV, commercial industry up here, and essentially just kind of worked my tail off. And, you know, it felt a little bit silly at times being kind of mature age as working as an entry level gig, but kind of do what you have to do, and all the while watching, learning, reading, writing, trying to make myself better as a storyteller. So the past 6, 7, 8 years I've been in the industry up in Sydney and worked my way up. So my day job now is more or less as a first AD, running sets in the commercial world. And along the way, I've worked on numerous films and TV projects and whatnot. But, you know, it sounds a bit heartless. The commercials pay well, so it's right. A little bit take the money and run and give myself time to work on projects like Outback, because they're so time-consuming.
Right.
So that's kind of how I got to, I guess, a situation where I had a knowledge base of working on set and a history of writing shorts. And I thought I'd give writing a feature a go. And I'd been doing that for a couple of years. And I had a script that I was hoping to make as like a low-budget indie film, you know, that $2 million project with, you know, somewhat a name cast on board. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, Nicole Kidman announced a project, Angel of Mine. And on the surface, it sounded very similar. So it kind of took the steam out of that project. And I was back at square one with no feature. And I had a wife going back to work from maternity leave because we had our firstborn. And I had like a window of 3 months to try and come up with a concept, write, shoot it, get it in the can. And then I knew I'd take a bit of time to go through post-production to finish the film. But at least if I had it in the can, I knew I'd be daddy daycare for a little while with the bub, and I could just chip away at having it cut together and doing the VFX and sound and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's how I got to the stage of shooting Outback. And we took about a year in post-production, and not having a great deal of money to throw at it, I was quite careful in slowly putting it together in the best possible way, using the resources and the people I've met along the way, and reaching out to people, talented, you know, whether it be sound designers or colorists, and working within their schedule, and hopefully presenting an appealing assembly or rough cut or, you know, final edit of the film. And I think people will gravitate towards projects that have passionate filmmakers behind them and, you know, have quality about them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I do want to talk more about Outback, but before we get into sort of the nitty gritty of how you made the film and everything you went through, your experience and in terms of making the film as well as getting distribution for the film, I want to ask, you didn't go to film school. How did you learn filmmaking? I know you mentioned doing a bunch of shorts and things. Was it all just learn through experience and doing it? Or did you study, like, what books did you read, if you read any? Are there any things you watched or listened to? How did you learn filmmaking other than obviously just doing it and getting better as you went along?
Yeah, look, almost all the resources are out there online and somewhat free. Directors' commentaries, watching other short films, making short films and trying to work out why they're not that great or why they didn't connect, or seeing what how people do respond to them and trying to, you know, extract more out of the next story that you create. Working on other people's short films, reading books, all the usual books, from Save the Cat to The Hero's Journey. You know, podcasts, there's so many amazing podcasts out there like yours, been following it for a long time. So there's resources out there, and I, you know, I've probably somewhat been obsessed by it, which you kind of have to be, especially because I was picking it up when I was 30. You know, I've got a partner and you've got to present some form of kind of future for her.
Right.
So I had to take it quite seriously, and it's not like I'm 19 and you know, able to bumble around so much. And she's got a real job. She's a lawyer, so she's like the stable one in the family, and uh-huh. She's, you know, essentially allowed me to follow my dreams. And but with that comes some pressure to deliver.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, yeah, so, you know, like I said, all the usual avenues, podcasts, directors' commentaries, making content, trying to get better.
Mm-hmm. Now, specifically talking about Outback, I had read that you literally this was sort of a Robert Rodriguez style, do it yourself, grab a credit card, get some people that know what they're doing as well as yourself, and just go out there and write a contained film that you could shoot in a very short period of time. I read it was 10 days and you went out there and did it. But maybe you can just explain to everyone the catalyst, like the inception of how it came about, why you chose the story, because maybe you can explain it first. I have the background of having read a number of interviews of yours as research, so I know what the story's about. But maybe for those listening, you can explain what Outback the story's about, and how you decided to write this film and shoot this film specifically.
Yeah, so the simple premise is a young American couple come to Australia for a beachside vacation and they end up stranded in the outback. So it was a survival thriller. Things get pretty gnarly and desperate. And it's essentially riding on the back of everyone's expectations that the outback has got, creepy crawlies and Australia's full of critters and snakes that will harm you. So I was trying to factor in as much marketing kind of pre-awareness IP as to what the outback would have, and take a couple of fish out of waters, a couple of foreigners, and put them in it. Like I mentioned earlier, I had that feature that I thought we'd be able to make and that got announced. So that was gone. So, and like I mentioned, had a small window of time to try and squeeze something into a 3 month period. So when you want to make something, a lot of the budget will get blown out by multiple cast members, multiple locations, and I guess shooting within those constraints, whether it's moving the unit, the production to shoot in different locations and waiting for lighting and whatnot. So I thought of Open Water. You remember that shark film? Couple of people. Yeah. So I remember how the filmmakers made that and how it got released by Lionsgate. And it kind of lent on a true story, these people that get stuck in the ocean. So that's always been in the back of my mind as a production that was somewhat easy to execute. Now, not meaning shooting in water or with sharks is easy, but there was, a producer and a DP, director, and the actors essentially. And they almost, I think they did their own makeup and tracked their own costume and whatnot. So I needed something I could shoot in a compressed amount of time. So that was essentially going to be two actors. I thought, what have I got at my disposal? I've got Australia, the outback, and what's potentially going to translate to a large audience. Let's take a couple of a young American couple and put them in that scenario. And then I really just started designing the project around their stay in Australia, the characters, that is. And they would only need to be here for a week or so to end up in the outback. So that's, 7 days and nights. If I shot it somewhat chronologically, I could almost shoot it like a documentary. I'll pick them up. So the story starts at Sydney Airport. They fly in from LA. So I'll pick them up there and then literally, like a documentary, film it on the way out into the outback. And then we'd spend a handful of days out there. And, so I more or less knew my characters or cast and my location, and I kind of reverse engineered a storyline that would fit within that, that would be entertaining and thrilling and trade on the idea of the outback and Australia and what people think of it, meaning, the creepy crawlies and the critters and how vast the outback is. So I do feel like the project is really designed, and it's not me sitting in a room with a blank page saying, oh, what should I create here? It's like, what have I got at my fingertips? Like Robert Rodriguez in his book, kind of he breaks that down, doesn't he? See what you've got
Absolutely.
at
Rebel
your
Without a Crew.
disposal. Yeah, exactly. So I read that back in the day. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no,
Just like,
absolutely. And I think it's very smart to, I mean, everybody wants to tell whatever story it is they want without restraint. And in an ideal world, that's great. But I think in a practical sense, you did what was very smart and said, okay, well, this is what I have and this is what I can accomplish. How do I formulate my story around that? And it was extra smart, I think, for you to look at a film like Open Water, which has a similar premise. Obviously, it's a completely different film. They're in the ocean with sharks, and you're obviously in the outback of Australia. It's a very different story, but the storytelling lanes seem to be sort of parallel. And looking at Lionsgate, thinking, oh well, you know, looking at beyond just the storytelling and just the filmmaking, but in terms of what you can do with it after, because half of filmmaking is making the other film, making the film. The other half is doing, you know, trying to make a living at it, i.e. selling it, or, you know, whatever, whether it's your script or your film. So I think you were very, very smart in how you went about it, as because it's work. It's an industry. It's a job. It's not just going out there and shooting whatever it is you want to shoot. Not that you can't do that. You can, I think, and be successful. But at the same time, sometimes you make it much more difficult if you're not planning ahead. If you don't know where the road is going, sometimes it doesn't lead anywhere, no matter how interesting
agreed.
You are. And I think you did a great job.
I wear multiple caps too. So I wrote it with my writing partner, directed, produced, catered it, financed it. So yeah, I kind of want to make sure it's going to work.
Right. No, and I think that's great. So when you're shooting in the outback, just out of curiosity, how did you drive out to set every day, like drive 2 hours down the road to the desert? Because I'm assuming it's really desolate where you're shooting. I mean, at least from what I saw in the trailer. Or did you stay out there? Did you find a locale that had a, you know, a bed and breakfast or something that you could house the, you know, the small crew in that's a little bit closer?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And like, even to go back further in the production of the film, there were lots of little checkpoints that the film would either keep going or stop. So I had to find an actor, actress that I could kind of base the film on, because it was going to be a female protagonist. So if I didn't find her, I couldn't move forward. And then if I didn't find someone that could work opposite her, I couldn't move forward. And then when I got to the stage where I need to film out in Broken Hill in the middle of Australia, if I couldn't find the location, we couldn't film. Or if it rained, we couldn't film either, because it's not going to make sense. But I researched the location and found a cattle station that would hold up to 12 people in their own rooms with big kitchens and cooking facilities, this amazing cattle station. And we could film on their property because it's huge and vast. We wouldn't have any permit issues, any, you know, flying drone issues, any issues of traffic. So I secured that location also as a unit base to stay. And the lady was so lovely. I actually wrote a scene at the end of the film and put her into the film. You know, I won't spoil the film, but there's a cattle musterer that appears late in the film, and it's her. And she was so thrilled to be part of it. And it just so happened, too, that we shot the film chronologically, so we wouldn't use her till the very end. And it also meant that she was so helpful throughout the production, just keeping us fed and looking after us. And she doesn't get a lot of guests, so she was really thrilled that there was a film being shot there. That the lady's called Kim, so a little shout out to Kim. And yeah, so she looked after us. We had an accommodation to stay there, and we could film, you know, 360-degree shoot any which way, and it was amazing. But again, back to putting the project together, if I didn't find that location, I couldn't. I don't know how I would have made it work.
Right. Now, your actors, you'd said that it's an American couple wandering through the Australian outback, and, you know, their car breaks down and that kind of thing. Did you cast actual American actors, or are they Australian actors and that use American accents?
Australian actors that use American accents.
Okay, I was just curious if there were American actors that happened to be there, or they came out for it. Okay.
If I'd known of any down here, I would have reached out. Actually, I remember researching, trying to find people, because half my family's in LA. I've got some links to some Americans down here. But yeah, Lauren, who does an amazing job in the film, she does a lot of kids' parties, and she'll dress up as Disney characters.
Oh, I see.
So she does an American accent really well. And she's used to it, so she was really good at keeping in character and accent when we were filming.
Right, right. Now, the shooting Outback, I had read that it was a 10-day shoot, so you're able to shoot the whole thing, which is crazy fast in 10 days with everything you had going on there, which if you watch the trailer, when you're ha dealing with a lot of different things like animals and a vast distant location, I am sure it was incredibly challenging. How did you, I mean, because you've had experience working on film productions before, and especially in commercials, although commercials tend to shoot very slow for the amount of air screen time. I mean, you're shooting for 3 days, 2 or 3 days for a 30-second commercial. But how did you budget for this film? Like, you knew you had a certain amount of money you wanted to do, and how much did you think you could get done in a certain amount of time? But how did you actually schedule and budget? And did it turn out the way you had thought?
Yeah, so when I say I got the film in the can on a credit card, that's kind of right. Obviously, we've spent a bit more in post-production and all that side of the finishing of the film. But to get it in the can to shoot for 10 days, essentially done on a credit card. So I guess in the outline of the story, where we meet the characters and where they then go as locations, I recce that with the DP, the cinematographer. So they start at Sydney Airport and then they head out to the Outback. So I literally did the whole drive that the characters would be doing with the cinematographer as a recce, as a scout. And wherever we found places to stay for the cast and crew in the drive out to Broken Hill, because it's like over 1,000 miles to drive out there, I built in storylines and scenes for the characters in the film to be at these different locations. So if we're going to have lunch somewhere, or if we're staying somewhere for the night, a hotel, I'd, write a scene that that's where the characters are staying, and then shoot the scene when we arrived at the next location, essentially. So, the route that we drove out to Broken Hill, the middle of Australia, I just created storylines. When we stopped at a petrol station about 6, 8 hours out of Sydney, there was this great old service station, petrol station, and this man came out and served us, and there's no one around, it's in the middle of nowhere. And I asked him, if we came through in a couple of months' time, would it be all right to shoot a scene here over the course of an hour? And he thought it would be great fun. So, put a little bit of money aside for him in an envelope, and tell him we'd be back, and lo and behold, we came back, and he was gracious to let us shoot a scene there. So, all of a sudden you've got a scene at a petrol station that's ancient and dusty and looks amazing from an art department perspective. I bring the actors in, we pull our car outside, bring the actors in, the sound guy, the DP, the camera, and shoot a scene. We've got it all scripted. They're rehearsing in the car. They know their lines. We do it multiple times, and we just continually do that. I obviously wrote scenes in the car so that when we're traveling on the days driving out to Broken Hill, there's scenes that the characters are playing in the car, and we're traveling, getting closer to the destination we need to. Because those first 4 days, we traveled over 1,000 miles to get out to Broken Hill where we filmed.
So the scene at the service station, the petrol station, scenes in the car, did you have all of that written in advance? Like, had you done a scout before, or were you writing it as you were driving and then giving them pages
Oh,
as?
no. It's all buttoned down. It's all as scripted.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We might play a few lines,
Sure,
but it
sure.
was such a linear story and a simple story in the sense that it unfolds over the course of 6 days. So there wasn't a lot to track costume-wise. There wasn't a lot, makeup we tracked more or less chronologically because they deteriorate out in the outback. But you couldn't kind of make up scenes. It was all scripted, and that was kind of the condition too from the wife early on, that there needed to be a script in place before, she'd somewhat be happy with me leaving her with a 2-month-old baby and, spending up on the credit card.
And so there, you had a script before you started the journey. Did you write anything on the way, or everything went according to your script as you had written it? I mean, obviously you ad lib once in a while and, go off book once in a
Because
while.
it was so tightly wound, the production, we had to be at places certain times, and it had to be scripted, had to be scheduled out, mapped out. There wasn't time to make things up. So the first 4 days, more or less, was driving out to the middle of Australia, Broken Hill, where we were going to spend the next 6 days. It was actually going to be an 11-day shoot, but the drive out there was so taxing. The cast and crew said, "Hey, we can't drive back in 1 day. We need 2 days." So I had to squeeze the remaining, what was going to be 7 days, into 6 days. So when I got out there, I had to kind of reconfigure how we can shoot what we were going to shoot. And we did it, but it meant 1 day we shot 17 pages of script, which is just, it's kind of ridiculous. But, and the night before we had to do it, we were like, "Oh my God, I don't know if we can do this." And everyone's looking at each other going, "What the hell?" But it was one of those things. It's just one foot in front of the other. We start at this time and we just need to keep shooting. And I didn't get a lot of coverage. I didn't get many takes. It was kind of run and gun. All that said, it was a lot of fun. A bunch of friends off in the middle of nowhere, eating and drinking well and making a fun film. It was a lot of fun. Everyone would do it again.
Oh, I'm sure. And you've done, and it must have shown because it looks great in the trailer. So it came across in your work, and with the success, obviously selling it, which is the holy grail of independent filmmaking, getting distribution. It must be a rewarding feeling for you and the cast and crew. So.
Yeah, it's a little bittersweet because we were hoping to be in the States. There was going to be a theatrical release over there,
Oh, yeah.
obviously, given the virus and whatnot. That's all been put to the side, but everyone's safety and health is obviously paramount.
Yeah, and at least like a number of films that were scheduled to be released, either they got pushed way back to fall, or they're being released, like films like The Invisible Man or The Hunt are being released on demand. And Bloodshot was in theaters for what, maybe 2 weeks, and then they released it on demand because people need things to watch when we're all quarantined at home. So hopefully it'll find a good audience and get some good downloads. I don't know how they track that stuff, but hopefully the response will
Yeah,
be very good.
it's true though. Like when you say you don't know how that works, I like nor do we, and we'll find out over the next year or two, I guess, as different figures come in. But it is interesting. It's kind of hard to get access to that information too.
Right, even as a filmmaker, yeah. Yeah, and everyone has different sort of rules, but I know like Netflix and Amazon Prime, it's difficult to get how many views or downloads or however they consider them, watches on their shows. Like nobody really knows because they don't do advertising in their shows.
Yeah,
There's no
that's right.
reason for them to announce how many viewers a show has. So it can be difficult to tell how successful a show is, except for within the public arena, what sort of response it gets, and or if Netflix gives it another season. You just don't know. So it's kind of interesting. So with Outback, after you had shot the film, you had everything in the can, what was your next step? Obviously trying to find distribution, trying to find a sales agent. How did that work for you?
Well, like when you say in the can, so we've still got to edit it,
Oh,
do
sure,
visual
the whole
effects
post
and all the.
process, which I'm
So,
assuming.
okay, so you mean like a locked finished project, film?
Or whatever you use to attract a buyer or a sales agent of some kind.
Okay, so we had a sales agent, Red Sea Media, Crystal Hill in there. She's fantastic. She's been amazing. She reached out to us. I'm not sure how she was tracking it, why she was tracking it.
Oh.
Expressed interest in it. That's her job, to go find projects as well as develop and work with other filmmakers or projects on their slate. She was really keen to see a cut of it. I showed her, I
Was
think it was,
this
sorry?
before or after it had gone to a festival at all?
It wasn't even finished at this
Oh,
stage. I
okay,
would have shown
wow.
her, an edit that was without the final sound and may not even had the full color correction pass. And she loved it, wanted to get behind it. Cannes 2019, so last year, was not far off. I was in a situation where I didn't know what the film, how popular it might be with sales agents and distribution and whatnot. I thought it was going to be okay. I knew it would sound really good because we had the Fury Road Gatsby sound team doing our sound. And just hit it off with Crystal. And, you know, she said she'd love to take it to the Cannes Film Market, put an agreement together. And she did take it. We finished the film just in time for that. She showed it to a bunch of companies, obviously, over there. I went over there to meet her because I'd never met her in person and experienced the market. She said she'd had really strong interest. It had been like one of their hits for the festival and that Lionsgate was circling. And that was really exciting. I didn't believe most of it because, you know, you walk around the film market and there's every man and his dog trying to sell and peddle films. And it's like, this is, you know, surreal and it feels totally unbelievable. It's just like something out of Entourage. And, you know, I don't want to buy into the idea that, yeah, Lionsgate want your film. And it's like, I'm only going to be let down in that situation. Nothing good is going to happen. But lo and behold, they did end up taking it. And it's sold to a bunch of other territories around the world. But yeah, so Crystal reached out to us. We signed a deal with them. They took it to Cannes. It got strong interest there. You know, then although the film's not huge in budget or huge in kind of cast members, it's got a strong marketing hook. And that was something that was really important to build into the film when I was designing it early on. You know, you've got the outback, kind of everyone has an idea of the outback.
Yeah.
You've got a young couple in the outback. You've got all the creepy crawlies. And built into the story of Outback, the characters, you know, it's a really emotional, tragic love story. So it hopefully works on multiple levels.
Yeah, I mean, just the name Outback, you know where it's set. And you kind of have an idea of what is out there. And you can pitch it in literally a sentence or two, and you know exactly what you're getting. So I think it's... I think I read in an interview where you had mentioned it, but I agree with what you'd said that I can't believe no one else had done this before.
It seemed kind of obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially if you put Lionsgate at the front of it, Lionsgate and Outback, and then you go, okay, I know what I'm in
right.
for.
Right. You know exactly what you're getting, and not in a bad way, but you know what you're...
No, that's right.
Yeah. Now, what has that... What has having a film been bought by Lionsgate and being distributed, being released, what has that done for you in terms of career-wise, in terms of representation, in terms of meetings, in terms of other things? Has that put you out there yet, or is it still like the wave hopefully will come once the film comes out and you get more response to the film?
Yeah, hoping for a wave. Nothing's happened yet. I haven't been all that active in trying to chase representation because I figure, you know, it's better if they kind of come to you
sure.
or they see the project. I've also just been so busy trying to finish the film and deliver it. The amount of documentation you need to deliver a film and also the film file itself, the kind of QC checking it goes through from the studios, it's just insane. Especially, you know, I'm kind of making this film from my house.
Mm-hmm.
So I was somewhat organized, but yeah, it's been next level, that kind of documentation. But I'm looking, we were planned to be in America or LA to support the film for its release and have a bunch of things happening. But yeah, obviously no international travel, so that's going to be limited. And also the downturn is probably not the best time to try and go looking for representation, because I know it's tough for them at the moment. I've seen pay cuts and staff cuts here and there. So when it happens, it'll happen. In the meantime, I'm writing a couple of other projects and developing a few things. But definitely look to partner up with some representation at some stage. I'm super excited about it when it happens.
Now, do you have representation out in Australia, or how does that work?
No. Again, you know, I'd done the short films, but I didn't have something like Outback made yet. I'm sure at some stage it may or may not happen. That was one of the big things in making the film, like kind of, your questions moving towards, you know, what's it going to do for my career? And it's a big unknown for me. And yeah, it, I don't, expect anything and I don't wait for anything. I just keep on, you know, onto the next project, and hopefully people see me as an appealing proposition to get behind and work with.
Yeah, no, and that's a great way to look at it and a great way to sort of carry yourself. Just continue moving on to the next thing. And when it comes, it comes. And I think also when you had mentioned your script that you had sort of in development that sort of fell apart once, a similar project with Nicole Kidman sort of took off, and which had a similar, sounded similar in terms of theme or story. And you, instead of just dwelling on that or continuing to push that or finding something, you actually took the route to, I'm going to write something else and try to shoot something else and just move ahead because I have a window. I think that's inspiring, and that's great. That's very, very smart on your part.
And that project still exists. Like, I had a named actress on board, and she's still attached to the project. And I've learned so much making Outback that, you know, that project needs a rewrite and will be so much tighter and better for it. So that's one of the things I'm working on at the moment. And it is probably, you know, a key to having a career, or at least building one, is just always get better.
Yeah, absolutely. And continuing to, when one project stalls like that one did, move on to something else. It doesn't mean the first project is dead or it's, you throw it in the trash. It just means you have to keep moving. And if that one stalls out, keep moving on something else. So, yeah. And you can always come back to it if the opportunity presents itself, or if you have the opportunity to do it. So I think that's great.
Yeah, you just need to get that wheel turning, don't you?
Yeah. Now, have you tried to find representation either in Australia or in the US before? Or is it something you just, like you had said, that you hopefully they'll come to you, but have you tried to go out to them before?
No, I've never really had anything of enough substance or prestige, you know, to warrant that. I know some people might have a short that pops here and there and, you know, might get representation, but no, I haven't. I'm looking forward to working with one of the films I worked on over the years was Truth. Mm-hmm. So that was Jamie Vanderbilt's directorial debut, which he shot here in Sydney with Cate Blanchett, Robert Redford, a whole host of names. So I was his assistant on that film, and I looked after him in post-production too. And he's like a dear friend and a bit of a mentor now. But, you know, I get a lot of insight into, or I did get a lot of insight to how agents and the managers and the kind of Hollywood system worked. One of the producers, or a couple of producers on that film, one was Brad Fisher, so that's Zodiac, Black Swan, mm-hmm. Shutter Island, he was behind, William Sherrick, who's done, you know, producing films from the age of 20, I think he was.
Yeah.
So just their stories and conversations and just soaking that all up. So, you know, when you kind of see that level of talent working, I was making short films, and, you know, I've only just finished Outback, and yes, it's Lionsgate are releasing it, and that's super exciting, but, you know, I'm probably only now really a proposition for an agent or a manager to get behind, because how else would they sell what I was doing?
What did you learn working for James Vanderbilt when you were working on Truth? What are some of the things that you learned by watching them work on Truth that you were able to use and adapt to Outback or in future films that you found super helpful?
Yeah, like I researched all the filmmakers that were involved with that film, like Jamie and the producers, and like, you know, they're just dudes and dudettes. They love what they're doing. They're super passionate about it. They'd been doing it for some time. You know, Jamie, I think it was USC, and he'd sold his first script when he was just coming out of that. So they'd been around a while, although they're kind of young 40s, late 30s. So a lot of it, you know, the mystique was kind of pulled back, and it's like, hey, these are just people doing it, and you just need to be as passionate and dedicated. The talent will come, or you may just inherently have talent in whatever field you're choosing within the industry. But it's just kind of get on with it and do it. And I remember some advice that Jamie told me that stuck with me. And it was essentially whatever it takes. So whether that's writing your script or making the film or getting someone attached to your project, whatever it takes, you just do it. It's just whatever it takes. So I've very much had that in the back of my mind, and I'm really grateful for the time I spent with him.
Great.
But yeah, whatever it takes.
That's good advice. Whatever it takes.
Yeah, I know. It's so broad, but so specific. And
Yeah.
just sums it up. It's like Nike, isn't it? Just do it. It's like whatever it takes.
Right. You've also been, I read, a judge for Scriptapalooza for a number of years, reading scripts and things. What is that like? Can you peel back a little bit of the layer in terms of like when you're,
Like it's a lot of work.
yeah.
You get sent a bunch of scripts. They come in all shapes and sizes, and literally, I mean all shapes and sizes. Some just stop on page 40, and it's like someone just felt, like they needed to send something in and be part of it. And there's might be a 160-page opus. So it's a lot of work. It's a big commitment. But for me, it's one of those skills that I just felt like, was helpful to stay on top of reading scripts, having pressure on me to read lots of scripts, seeing what's out in the marketplace, seeing what other writers are doing, getting a gist of why things don't work and, why you do keep wanting to turn the page on some scripts. And then you'd kind of scorecard them and send them back. But yeah, it's a big commitment and it's something you have to want to do.
Now, being a judge for a screenplay competition, I'm sure you've read hundreds, literally, of scripts. What are some of the things that stand out when you're reading a script? When something turns out to be good, like what are some of the signs that you see right away?
It's normally pretty clear when someone knows what they want to say early on. You just have there's a sense of confidence in the writing that you just feel, whether it's word choice or brevity. It's just short and concise, and it gets the reader involved, and you want to turn the page. So, and for me, a lot of what I think people should do is cut. That simple old adage about entering a scene late, getting out early. And that's, I think, not only for a scene, but a screenplay itself.
Right.
You know, you, rarely does cutting something make the read not as good. It's just normally makes it better.
Yeah.
Cut, cut, cut.
Right. Along with that, what are some of the common mistakes you see in scripts that sort of fall apart? In addition to obviously not editing enough, not cutting it down enough, not trimming and editing enough. But what are some of the other common mistakes you see? Like you, when you're reading, you realize that this probably is not going to be very good.
Like it's a generalization, but you do come across a lot of scripts that just feel like they're from, eons ago, an era and a tone of storytelling that isn't relevant today. And it just feels like the writer isn't in touch with the industry. And I don't mean that you should be chasing a trend or a fad. It just feels like, and maybe that's not fair to say that. Maybe this is their hobby and this is what they want to write. So, I'm not, ju I guess I'm judging it in the sense of it's in a contest to try and place, to try and get representation, to try and be made. Whereas maybe people, a lot of people are just entering it because that's what they want to do and they're not chasing a career in the industry. I just don't want to be too hard on people too. But yeah, it's that story and the tone of story that's just feels like it's from another era.
What percentage of scripts that you have read for either for the screenplay competition or just, yeah, I guess for the competition, not just in general, because I'm sure you've read a lot of professional scripts and a lot of produced scripts that were made into films and shows and things. But the scripts that are submitted to screenplay competitions, of the hundreds you've read, what percentage would you say are actually, like, would you think are good scripts? Like, this is something that I think is a high quality script.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Kevin. And it's something I kind of take note of when I'm going through them. We get sent 50 scripts, and I reckon there might be one that edges into recommend, and there's maybe two or three that are like, ugh. But if you recommend a project, you're telling someone to take, a couple of hours, an hour or so out of their life to read this. You want it to reflect good on you recommending it. So it's really hard to write a great script. Probably tells you a sense of, the screenplay contest that it's for everyone to be involved, and there's all sorts of writers submitting their scripts in. So, but it's really tough and scarce to find a script that you recommend.
Now, regarding your own writing, in terms of features and things, where do you get feedback from? Like, who do you ask to look at your script before you send it out to wherever you're going to send it on a professional level, whether it's being read by producers or cast or whatever you're going to decide to show it to the world outside of your trusted circle? Where do you tend to get feedback from first?
So I've got a writing partner, Brian mm-hmm. Kelly, who's an LA native. And so we'll work on something together for some time. I might send it off to a coverage agency. I haven't done it for ages. I wouldn't even know. I'd have to stop and think about where I'd send it to. But I've got a couple of writing friends, a writing circle that I'd send it out to. Because I've made Outback and I haven't written a script for a while other than what I'm outlining at the moment, I haven't done it for a while. But, you know, I think it's smart too, as long as it's not costing you too money, start with your friends and whatnot. But then if you need an independent set of eyes, you know, spend a little bit of money and get an outsider's opinion. It doesn't mean what they say is hard and fast, you know, black and white Bible, but it could spark you and it head off another direction or tighten what you have. So I think getting outside feedback is imperative, whatever step of the filmmaking journey you are. Like, even with Outback, you know, I had scorecards created, a Google Doc that I could send a rough cut of the film to different people, and they could just quickly click on a Google Doc after they'd watched the assembly or rough cut or finished film, mm-hmm. and they could kind of judge it. And, yeah, for me, I don't take the feedback personally, whether it's the writing or the film or, you know, I'm sure people are going to have all sorts of things to say about the film Outback, but it is what it is. I'm interested in reading it, I'll take, you know, when I'm bored in the right way, hopefully, but I won't let it get to me.
Right. Now, just jumping out of film land and into real life, because a lot of us, a lot of writers, a lot of listeners, just everybody really is sort of holed up during this quarantine, I just want to find out from you how you're personally handling it and what's going on with you. Are you being creative? Are you just sort of taking a break? It sounds like you've got a lot going on still with the film and with your other projects, but maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, because I wear multiple caps, a lot of the producery work that I'm doing with delivering the film is mind-numbingly boring and just kind of crunching contracts and different things like that. It's been really hard to get creative and put ideas down, to the point where I hadn't for some time, and I've only just started getting back into it the last 6 months or so, now that the film's delivered. But it's hard. I've got a writing partner. I normally work with a writing partner, so I've got Brian, and there's a couple of other people I've got ideas bouncing around with. But I find if I want to spend some time writing or coming up with ideas, that it's a first thing in the morning time slot, and it's before I start, you know, looking at emails and different issues that I might have to deal with Outback or other projects. It's kind of just give myself a block of time just to deep dive into this creativity, probably have a coffee or two and explore on the page.
So what other ways do you use to sort of jumpstart your creativity? You had mentioned a couple, like having extra coffee and things like that. What other ways have you found that are able to help you motivate?
My exercise of choice is running. So I try and get out every couple of days. And that, I feel like, helps my creativity. Just the endorphins of running, getting out there, you know, the breathing and the sense of exercise. You know, maybe it also makes you feel good, and in feeling good, creativity comes from that energy as well. But sure, that would be in the afternoon after, hopefully, a morning session of writing and outlining.
Right.
But you kind of pick up ideas everywhere too, don't you? You know, if you're watching something or if you're interacting with people, I'm kind of always making notes in the back of my head of different moments and ideas.
Yeah, no, sometimes when you're not thinking about a problem is when the solution comes, or when you get ideas,
Yeah,
things like that,
that's right.
as opposed to beating yourself over the head just trying to figure out how to make this idea work. Sometimes not thinking about it is when the answer comes to you.
Very much.
How's the quarantine out in Australia? The
Oh, it's pretty tough. Like our
yeah.
schools are still open
Oh,
and
wow.
childcare. Yeah. I think we're quite lucky in Australia how, we're essentially an island and there haven't been too many deaths. As bad as one death is, hasn't been too many. It's been somewhat contained. So I think it's going to be here for, 6 to 12 months at least, this isolation. But I know that the media's already started to kind of have a little bit of good news about the projection of the outbreak of the virus and whatnot, its containment. But and just on that, I'm already designing my next two scripts to be shot with limited cast, limited locations, so I can hopefully shoot them sooner rather than later,
Oh, that's
because
great.
with more people, whether it be cast or crew, talent, it just becomes more complications in this post-virus or this virus world that we live in at the moment.
I love the way that you're thinking about that because I hadn't even thought about it. And then some writers have been having conversations, and I've spoken with a few other writers who have brought it up, that is the market going to change? Is the demand for different types of scripts going forward, at least in the short term future, going to change? Are people going to want the same? Are the studios going to want the same things? Are tentpole movies going to slow down, and maybe limp small based comedy is going to be in? I mean, nobody really knows, but that's definitely something that people are thinking about. But something that nobody has mentioned except for you, which I think is very fascinating, is that the logistical, maybe this is your producing background, or but the logistical aspect of it, like doing things that are small and contained, is safer to shoot, and that has its own appeal to it because of the fact that you're exposing fewer people, and it becomes less of a risk, and so it becomes much safer and much easier in that sense to shoot, which I think is very, very interesting. I had not thought about that.
Well, if you think of the logistics, you're almost going to have to isolate all your crew and cast members at one location, so one hotel or one kind of living quarters, and you might have to lock them down for a 4 week, 5 week period or whatever it is. They won't be able to go see their family. There won't be any kind of outside interaction with people, and that's probably going to be the world we'll live in for, the foreseeable future. So I'm very much designing a couple of projects to be shot in that environment.
No,
Because otherwise, how are you going to get something made?
No, that's fascinating, and you're the first person that I've heard bring that up. So I think that's interesting and smart. I mean, I think you're going about it as you have with Outback in a very, very smart way. So I don't know. Yeah, I think that's pretty amazing. So the projects you're working on, are they set in a specific location that has access to a hotel, or is that something you would travel between the hotel and that location back and forth, just and not allow anyone to
Permeate.
permeate within the public? Because I understand that sports leagues are considering doing that, whether it's the NBA or the Premier League or whatever. They're considering having all games at a few different stadiums and have all the teams in hotels locally and play in those same stadiums with empty stadiums. And they only can go back and forth between the hotel and the stadium, and their families can't be there. No, they can't have visitors. And so they're really isolating everybody, but that's how they're thinking they can continue these sports leagues and just show them on television. So it sounds
It's
like
gnarly, isn't
similar.
it? Yeah, when you think through, a player that might have kids, that might have family, someone maybe gets sick or something, but they can't go physically interact, they can't leave the bubble that they're in. You've got camera people, sound people, makeup technicians. It's huge. Costume, medical teams. It's so, I guess on a smaller scale with a film, just if you can limit the number of people involved. And you still have to design, again, design is the kind of word I keep going to, a concept that will facilitate something that's interesting enough to warrant, a release of some form. But yeah, I think that's going to be how things will be in 6 to 12 months for a little while. So there's also going to be like no one's filming anything at the moment, so there's going to be this whole kind of demand for content at some stage because the pipeline's gone empty.
No, absolutely. And
so if you can create something, maybe it's going to be valuable.
Again, that's very, very smart on your part, because you're thinking multiple steps ahead, which I think is brilliant, really. So, but one thing that I wanted to mention was, what was I going to mention? Let me write this down because I'm stumped here for a second. I don't know, I lost it. Anyway, so Outback comes out June 9th. Lionsgate, DVD, digital on demand, although I don't know if people are really getting DVDs nowadays. Like, you have to order through Amazon, and I know they're having shipping issues. But where can one watch Outback, digital and on demand, if they wanted to see it?
Well, yeah, again, good question. Yeah. And to the indie filmmaker, I'm not sure yet. the information will be quite scarce coming through from the Lionsgate and the sales agent. So I'm not sure if this is useful information, that this is what it's like to be an indie producer at the level, you know, the Outback's at, or if you want to cut this out of the podcast, Kevin, your call. But I thought from research that Lionsgate has an output deal with Hulu. So I'm wondering if it's on Hulu. But again, it's, you know, we are such a small fry in their big machine of content that I don't know if it's something that they get to when they get to, or if it's just slow in traveling because of the world and, you know, priorities at the moment. Reading up to, I saw Lionsgate, a lot of their marketing team got moved on not that long ago. So I don't know if that's slowed information down, but I don't know much at the moment. And sometimes it feels like that as an indie filmmaker. And I just trust that when it's time that they'll let us know. And, you know, it's kind of part of the relationship at this level of the industry. There's a lot of trust involved. So I trust the sales agent. They've been wonderful to date. They trust Lionsgate that they're going to do the right thing. And we'll get told, without me bugging the sales agent too much, when we need to, because they know we're here and standing by.
Right. Well, we'll put the link to the Lionsgate page for Outback, which I'm sure will have links or information on where people can watch on demand on digital. Because I'm sure they'll put it on their site, even if they don't tell you, they'll put it on their site. So
exactly. We know June 9th.
Yeah.
It was going to be a day and date release, but like I said, the cinemas obviously can't go to now. So I'm sure it'll be everywhere that Lionsgate normally put material out to.
Sure. Absolutely. And a lot of stuff, we were talking earlier before we started recording, a lot of stuff is being released on demand much sooner or in lieu of being in theaters because of the pandemic. Films like The Invisible Man or films like The Hunt. Bloodshot was in theaters for 2 weeks and then pulled and then put onto on demand and digital. So it's happening to a lot of films these days. Or they're getting pushed far, far, far into the future if they're huge budget films like Black Widow or something like that, that they don't trust to necessarily make their money back on demand. But yeah, the rest are being released on demand because people are hungry for things to watch, I guess.
Yeah. We've always had that June 9th date in place. So they haven't moved that, but yeah, you're right. And again, like, it'll be interesting in 3 months' time, like, what kind of content will they have to release if they've been releasing a lot of stuff and nothing new's coming through?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely will be. And I know that some writers on shows that are currently still working in writers' rooms, virtual writers' rooms, I should say, they're ordering extra episodes. So when they do go into production, they have a lot more to shoot already.
Yeah, cool.
But as far as actually shooting, yeah, I mean, who knows what's going to happen going forward if this lasts for, you know, any prolonged period of time other than a month or two, how the distribution chain is going to be disrupted. It'll be interesting to see. So I do think it's very fascinating to have your mentality of what can we shoot within the framework of quarantine, You know, how can we make it still work? And how can I still shoot something and remain safe and keep our cast and crew safe and still shoot and produce material, produce projects that, you know, what is feasible and possible? And I think you're thinking, again, two steps ahead, which I think is fascinating. So, yeah, for
Yeah, I
those.
got hungry mouths at home.
Yeah. thank you so much for coming on, Mike. I do appreciate it. It's been great to hear your story and how you were able to come up with your film Outback. So everyone check that out on June 9th on Lionsgate. We'll have the link wherever that
Thanks,
leads.
Kevin. I love the podcast. Been listening to it for ages.
Well, thank you. And do you have any other words out there for those filmmakers out there who are going to try to shoot something during the quarantine or write something for during the quarantine?
Oh, well, stay safe and well, I guess. But for me, it's all about getting the wheel turning, and whether that's starting small and not spending too much, or, reaching for something bigger if you've been doing something smaller, but just keep improving.
Right. Whatever it
And
takes,
be
right?
nice. Be nice too. There's so many people out there that, excuse me, aren't all that nice about it. Be nice about it.
Right. No, absolutely. And what's your Twitter handle?
I don't use Twitter, and
You don't use social media.
don't use a lot of
You have
social
your own
media.
website though, right?
Yeah, I'm storyposse.com is the company framework that I work under. But
Storyposse.com.
yeah, I don't use a lot of social media. And we also got Outback the movie, so that's a
Okay.
Facebook site.
OutbackTheMovie.com. We'll have links, but OutbackTheMovie.com.
Is it at Outback the movie? I'll send you the link.
Okay. And we'll have that up. So thank you again. Really appreciate it, Mike.
Thanks, Kevin. Look forward to meeting you someday.
Yeah, hopefully you'll come out to LA when this is all over. We can have a coffee or a beer
In
or
and out
something.
burger, a burger.
Yeah. So everyone else out there, stay safe, be well, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.